Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a free ebook for you to download today that you won't want to miss. It's called In Conversation with Jordan Peterson, Atheism, Christianity, and the Psychology of Belief. This special ebook was created from an unbelievable podcast with famed Canadian psychologist Jordan Peterson. And in it, you'll discover how to bring order to a chaotic world using the wisdom of the Bible. So download your free copy of In Conversation with Jordan Peterson by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. This is a limited time offer, so make sure to do it today. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Well, good afternoon and welcome along to the programme. I'm Justin Brierley, your host for Unbelievable between now and 4 o'clock. Yes, every Saturday afternoon, this is the place where Christians and non-Christians get together to discuss various aspects of faith and belief. And, well, we're approaching Christmas. This is the closest show to Christmas. And so I've tried to give a little bit of a Christmas flavour to today's programme. And you'll see why as we unpack today's issues. This is, of course, part of the Faith Explored range of programming every Saturday afternoon here on Premier Christian Radio. And don't forget that a little later on today, between 4 and 5, a special interview with Cliff Richard. What could be more Christmassy than that? That's in the profile interview. He's speaking to Dave Rose here on Premier Christian Radio between 4 and 5. So make sure you stay tuned for that, as well as all the other good programming coming your way, and of course over the Christmas period itself here on Premier Christian Radio. If you want to find out more about today's show, get past shows, resources, more about my guest, then do visit the website of Unbelievable. That's premier.org.uk/unbelievable. And I look forward to you interacting with today's programme as well via email and, of course, via the Twitter and Facebook accounts for the show. And I'll be giving you the details of how to get in touch that way a little later on. Let me introduce you to what we're talking about on today's programme. You're unbelievable. Well, last week we started a series of three programmes asking, was Jesus just a... And today we're asking, was Jesus just a rabbi? This is, of course, partly because Channel 5 are at the moment screening a 10-hour Bible mini-series throughout December. And we're looking at the central figure of that series, Jesus, asking various questions around who he was. Last week we asked, was Jesus just a zealot? And this week, as Christmas approaches, we ask, was Jesus just a rabbi? Or was he more? Was he, as the Christmas festival commemorates, the long-promised Messiah of the Jews? Well, two guests join me today, both by the name of David, which is going to be very confusing, but we've worked out a way of possibly differentiating them. They are David Instone Brewer and Rabbi David Lister. Let me introduce them both to you today. A very good afternoon to you both, gentlemen. Thank you for being with me on the programme today. Rabbi David Lister, welcome to the programme. Would you like to give us a little idea of who you are, where you're from? I understand you helped to lead Edgware United Synagogue. And would you like to tell us a little bit about what your job involves and what you do there?
Right. Thank you for having me on the show. It's lovely to be here. My job involves teaching and caring for people in the Jewish community in Edgware and around and about. So I preach in my synagogue on Saturday mornings, and I teach children in the Sunday school that we have, prepare them for their bar mitzvah, and I teach people about Jewish texts. So we have regular meetings that we do where we talk about bits of the Jewish oral law and the written law as well. So we have a weekly look at the portion of the week from the five books of Moses. I visit people in hospital, I officiate at funerals, and care for people when they're close to death, and guide people in aspects of Jewish law, and much more besides.
Yes, obviously, I'm sure that doesn't encapsulate everything that a rabbi does, but would you say that's pretty typical of the typical duties of a rabbi in modern Britain?
It depends what kind of community you're with. The more scholarly communities, the more learned communities would expect the rabbi to do less pastoral work and more teaching work.
Absolutely. And of course, there is a distinction between Orthodox Judaism and Reform Judaism. Do you want to just give an outline of what that is, essentially, for those who perhaps aren't familiar?
Right. Very simply, whereas the non-Orthodox Jewish movements regard Jewish law as something that does and should evolve over time, Orthodox Jews say that the law as we received it from God is one that we should keep for all time.
Mm. And just to be clear, which one you are?
I'm Orthodox.
Yes, you're Orthodox. Yeah. And so at what point did that sort of split or separation, those two streams emerge, as it were?
Well, people have been splitting away from traditional Judaism for a long time. I think the Reform Orthodox split happened in Germany in the 19th century, as far as I'm aware. And there have been other splits off it since then. But, you know, we Orthodox just carry on the same as best we can.
Yeah. Our other guest on the programme today, as we discuss this question before us, was Jesus just a rabbi, is the Reverend David Instone Brewer. Using your sort of ordained title, just to distinguish you from our other David this morning, Reverend David Instone Brewer. You're no stranger to this programme. You're a scholar at Tyndale House in Cambridge, specialising, though, in rabbinics, which I think is particularly why I wanted you on the programme today. So can you give us a little idea of how you particularly got interested in the rabbinics of the New Testament, David?
I wanted to understand the New Testament. I wanted to understand what Jesus was talking about when he used different terminology and understand how Paul was arguing in such a strange way. So in order to understand that, I needed to understand them. And they were Jews, they were first century Jews, so I needed to understand first century Jews. And of course, Orthodox Judaism, the Baptist go right back to John the Baptist, and people have been splitting off from the Baptist Church for a long time. The Catholics split off, you know, and then Orthodox split off, but the Baptist Church has remained the same.
That's one way of putting it, I suppose. Thanks for being on the programme today. We're going to talk about this question, was Jesus just a rabbi? Why don't you give us a little bit of background from the research you've done over the years, David, Reverend David at this point, of how you conceive the role of a rabbi was different then to what it perhaps is now, if and what those differences are, what the similarities might be.
The Judaism before 70, when the temple was destroyed and Jerusalem was almost emptied and virtually and Jews were almost wiped out, was very different. Since then, Jews have worked together and they all agree together and they meet together to decide what they believe. But before 70, there were so many different groups of people. The Dead Sea community, there were different rabbinic groups, and different rabbinic groups all disagreed with each other, and they loved disagreeing. And so it's tricky to fit Jesus in exactly, because there are so many different people with so many different beliefs. But it's such an interesting time, because there's such lively discussions about everything, about theology, about the Bible, about how you live your life. Mm. And it's still interesting after 70, but things calmed down so much.
Okay. I don't know sort of whether you, Rabbi David, particularly sort of have an interest in going back to the first century and the type of the way that the rabbinical duties were organised there, what people did, what the different groupings were, and so on. Is that something that comes up in your training, sort of looking back at how the role of rabbi has emerged over the centuries?
Not especially, no. We tend to focus very much on the rules. And for Orthodox Jews, the law is absolutely central, as Jesus indeed picked up on in his dialogue with the Pharisees. So for us, it's more a question of looking back to the text of the five books of Moses and seeing how that has been passed down to us with what we consider to be a contemporaneous oral tradition that explains it, until it's written down for the first time in the year 200, which is the beginning of the Talmud. And so the year 70 for us is an important date, because it marks the destruction of the Second Temple. So it was a very sad time for us, and we consider that to be the start of an exile that endures to this day. But I think for us it's more about the law than about the people.
Sure, absolutely. Well, we're going to get into this discussion now, and I'd be really interested to hear from you as we get into it, Rabbi David, of what you make and what Jewish people generally make of the character of Jesus. And of course, we'll have the Reverend David as well chiming in on that. As we asked today, was Jesus just a rabbi? And if you'd like to have your say on today's programme, you can, of course, get in touch via email. As usual, that's unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. If you want to like the page, it's facebook.com/unbelievablejb. And you can follow me on Twitter. That's my handle, @unbelievablejb, if you want to do that. Do tell me what you think about today's programme. Always enjoy hearing your feedback. And don't forget, towards the end of today's programme, we'll hear some of your feedback on recent shows. Today, as I've mentioned, we're asking, was Jesus just a rabbi? And if you want more information on the guests who are joining me on today's programme, David Instone-Brewer and Rabbi David Lister, then do go to the website of Unbelievable. That's premier.org.uk/unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Coming back to you, Reverend David, tell us why you believe Jesus could be described as a rabbi in the first century.
A rabbi wasn't really a title in the first century like it is now. That didn't really come in until the second century. But in the first century, it was rather like a reverend was before reverend became a title. Mm. You know, you talk about a reverend gentleman, or you talk about someone who's very reverend, and it's a description. Mm. And a person who is a teacher, a rabbi means my teacher or my great one.
So when we read in the New Testament, for example, moments when someone approaches Jesus and says, teacher, could that equally have be translated rabbi or something?
Yes,
like that.
Yes, certainly. They would be saying rabbi or rab.
Yeah. And in the sense that that was a somewhat a loose terminology at that point, was there any official, as it were, office of a rabbi that one would be trained into or have to fulfil certain qualifications to be?
There were no offices that ordained people as rabbis, but there were ordained teachers. You had teachers who were ordained by your teacher.
Okay.
And the teaching authority is passed down through different schools. And sometimes a very great person would come along and found a new school. So you get the schools of Hillel, you get the schools of Shammai, because a person called Hillel founded it, and a person called Shammai founded it.
And so in Jesus' day, what were, as it were, the predominant schools of teaching that were in play?
Embarrassingly, we don't actually know. We know about Hillel and Shammai because we have 300 disputes between them, which were recorded.
Always helps if you have disputes, doesn't it?
Yeah, but they were a small group when they got together. They met in one room.
Oh, okay. Well, I always think this programme could be a historical resource, given the number of disputes we have on here, you know, at some point down the line. But carry on, yes.
But we also know that there was a school of Gamaliel, for instance, and we know one of his pupils, we know of Paul. But there must have been many other schools that we've just lost all knowledge of. And so the people at Qumran were part of the Essenes. They weren't really a school in the same way. But you had these groups who would ordain people, or at least their pupils would become recognised teachers, but not necessarily ordained in the same way that rabbis were later.
And how did rabbis in that sense fit into the structure of the Jewish religious system, as you're aware, in terms of obviously there was a priestly sort of caste, if you like, and other types of office that one could hold. So how did that all fit together?
Yeah, well, there again, we are embarrassingly ignorant. We know that these teachers of the law, may have been a title of a particular group. And we know they are scribes, and they had to be around to write letters and whatnot, but they may also have been teachers in their own right. But the big group, of course, were the Sadducees, who believed something quite different from the most of the rabbinic schools. They believed only in the Torah. They wouldn't have any rest of the Old Testament, and they didn't have any belief in the resurrection or any afterlife.
So they were essentially sort of almost atheistic as regards the afterlife. They didn't believe that we existed after death.
They certainly were not atheists. They believed in one God.
Yes, but they
thought when you're dead, you're dead.
You're dead, you're dead, as it were. Okay, very interesting. And the priests, that was... Is that something that went back, obviously, to...
Yeah, the priests, they had a job to do. They had to look after the temple. They were professionals. And when Christianity came along, a lot of the priests joined Christians and became Christians.
But they
were, some of them were rabbis, right, among the rabbi groups, and some were Sadducees.
Yes, so they could have a dual function in that sense, both carrying out the religious observances as well as teaching and so on. Thank you very much. That helps to put us in the picture a bit. What's your view of Jesus, Rabbi David? How do you think of him? When you think of Jesus, do you think of a rabbi, who, rather like yourself, but who lived 2,000 years ago? Or do you think of something completely different?
As I mentioned before, we consider there to be a tradition about how to understand the five books of Moses, which dates back to when they were given to us. And it's a bit like if you've got a lecture and lecture notes. We consider the five books of Moses to be like the lecture notes. And the oral law, which was finally written down in the Talmud, is like the lecture itself. Now, as far as we're concerned, anybody who stays on that path of following the traditional explanation of the five books of Moses is legitimate. Mm. But if they stray from that path, then they no longer have any credence. They may be well-meaning. They may want to do good, and that's great. But we say that the best way to do good, certainly for a Jew, is to follow the five books of Moses with that traditional interpretation. And of course, we regard the later prophets as merely a sort of expanded commentary on the concepts which are laid down and the rules that are laid down in the five books of Moses.
So how does Jesus play into that? Was he following in that tradition, or was he doing something different as far as you're concerned?
I think he was somewhat deviating from it. So, for example, he, correct me if I'm wrong, I think he permits his disciples to pluck ears of grain on the Sabbath, which for traditional Judaism is an absolute no-no. It's a violation of the Sabbath, and that's a very serious matter. And he has a justification for it. He says, what is here is greater than a temple, and so on. But the explanation he gives would absolutely not wash according to our conception of what the Sabbath is. And so we regard him as stepping out of that tradition and doing his own thing.
And in that sense, would personally wouldn't therefore give him the title rabbi? You'd say he was less than a rabbi in some ways, as far as your...
It depends. Well, we risk getting bogged down in the details here. It depends how you define a rabbi, I suppose. Yeah. If you regard a rabbi as being somebody who follows that ancient tradition, then I'd say he's not a rabbi. If you call anybody who teaches other people a rabbi, then, as David says, he did teach people. So you pay your money, takes your choice.
Come in on this, David, Reverend
David. David is being very polite about Jesus. Really, Jesus threw out the traditions that that Rabbi David holds so dear, because in his day they were new traditions, the traditions of the elders that he said were just written on top of God's law, and he rejected
them. But keeping the Sabbath holy, it was obviously something fundamental.
Well, that was written into the God's law in Torah.
Absolutely.
In the books of Moses.
And from what you're saying, David, you feel that the story of Jesus, when his disciples are criticized for plucking ears of corn and so on, and he says, the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath, and so on, that was very much out of keeping with traditional Orthodox Judaism.
Absolutely. I'll need to get a bit technical here. The five books of Moses define what we may or may not do on the Sabbath as malacha, which is a Hebrew word, and it's not actually explained in the five books of Moses beyond that. It just stops there. It doesn't mean hard work, because you see, when the Jewish people are enslaved in Egypt, that term is not used. Rather, it's a code word, if you like, which the oral tradition explains to mean any of 39 different forbidden activities, the very first one of which is sowing, and the next one is harvesting. So if you pluck an ear of corn on the Sabbath, you've done that, and that's not meant to be done.
So do you think Jesus was radically stepping outside the traditional interpretation of the Torah in that story, David?
In that story, there would be some rabbis of Jesus' day who would let him do that. They said that you could take a handful of food and not tithe it and eat it. And so the plucking is just preparing a handful. But there were other rabbis who disagreed with that. Everyone was in disagreement about something in the first century, and you could always find someone to back you up. But yeah, he was In his justification, he didn't say, well, some rabbis say that you can take a handful. He said, oh, it's the Sabbath, it's made for man.
Right. Yep. And as far as we know of these other schools that existed at the time, would you say that Jesus appeared to follow or follow in the footsteps of a particular other rabbi or teacher?
Well, there are always people saying the same thing as Jesus. For virtually everything that Jesus says, you can find someone else who's saying the same thing. But there are no groups that are saying the same range of things as right. Jesus. Jesus sometimes agreed with Hillelites, sometimes with Shammites, sometimes with the Essenes, the Qumran people, sometimes even with Sadducees. But he never was any of them. He was his own man.
Right, okay. So nowadays, how in general, and you can't speak for all Jewish people, obviously, Rabbi David, but is Jesus seen as really a Christian character rather than a Jewish person?
I think he is, yeah. We don't really refer to Jesus much because, as I said before, our main focus is the law and what we can do with it for the good of the whole world and our relationship with God. And inasmuch as we see Jesus as having stepped away from that, he's not really a big figure for us.
Yeah.
Now, I have a completely different experience of the Jewish world because I go to Jewish conferences, academic conferences, and meet with Jewish scholars and who are interested in the Bible and where we discuss things together. And they spend a lot of time looking at the Gospels. They almost spend more time with the Gospels than they do with Talmud because the Gospels tell them about first century Judaism and the Talmud has so little in it from that time. And they know a great deal about Jesus, and they speak a great deal about him. But, of course, not with the reverence that I would speak about him.
And what do they say about him at those conferences? Do they see him as an aberration from the norm, as it were, in some sense, or just symptomatic of the fact that there were lots of different people doing different things at the time?
If you take away the miracles and take away the resurrection, then Jesus does look like one of the strange teachers walking around Palestine. He's got a very distinctive message, a message of saying, hey, don't push yourself forward. God is greater than any man, and you should love your neighbour, and you should live for God. Of course, all Jews are teaching you should live for God, but the rest you have to pick and find in different places.
And his focus on the kingdom of God, which obviously comes through often.
That's very strange, because there he is emphasising almost a children's Judaism. In Judaism, you have the two yokes. You have the yoke of the kingdom and you have the yoke of the commandments. When you're a child, you follow the yoke of the kingdom, which is just the very basic commandments. You know, love God, love your neighbour. But when you become an adult, then you follow the yoke of the commandments. You take on the whole 613 commandments. You live the whole thing. And Jesus said, no, I have a light yoke. I have the yoke of the kingdom. And it's almost a child's Judaism he's teaching.
Yeah, any comments on that yourself?
I recognise that, yes, because what we say when a child comes of age, we say they're a bar or bat mitzvah, which means that they assume that their adulthood is marked by their assumption of a responsibility to keep the commandments, which is exactly as you say. Yeah,
it's interesting. What do you make of the accounts, as far as you've read them, of Jesus? Do you find them at all compelling in terms of the character that he was, Rabbi David? Is he for you just an interesting man who had some interesting things to say? Do you put him any higher than that, as it were, in how you see him as a character from history?
I find that his courage is quite compelling. He really cares about what he thinks, and he's prepared to go against the grain and upset lots of powerful people to get his message across, and ultimately he pays for it with his life. So, you know, you can't take that from him. On the other hand, I find it difficult to read his attitude to the law, because he regards it in such a negative way. And for Orthodox Jews, the law is everything. It's what it's all about. I mean, in Proverbs, it says that the Torah, the law, is like a light. And this is the very first thing that God created. Well, you know, let there be light. And we say that refers to the law. So it's such a profound and formative thing for us, and such an inspiring and beautiful thing, that it's difficult for us to see it as a negative thing or something that should be overridden.
I think Jesus would agree with you. Because in Matthew 5, which a lot of Christians use to say that he's against the law, he's not actually criticizing anything in the law. He only criticizes the things which have been added. It says you should love your neighbor but hate your enemy. Well, hate your enemy is in the community scroll in Qumran. He's saying, don't buy that. Mm. That's not part of the law. And he's criticizing things which are not in the Torah. And he says there's not one tittle of Torah which should fall, and we should be following all of it. I think he would be agreeing with you, but later Christians did not teach it quite that way.
Well, I'm not an expert in this, I must admit. it's not quite my field. But certainly the general drift of it, the New Testament as a whole, seems to be that, you know, nowadays we don't need to actually do these things.
Sure, of course, and indeed the religion, the Christianity, as it were, that came soon hot on the heels of Jesus, and if you like, St. Paul was the first missionary to take it beyond the Jewish people, very much defined itself on the fact that everyone could now be part of this, Gentile, Greek, slave, free, and so on. And I suppose then the question is, where did that leave the law?
I find this another thing where we Jews, we Orthodox Jews, are at variance with the Christian message, because we say that, in fact, from way back, every human being, as you say, can be a part of this in different ways. Mm. So we say that there are seven laws that everybody in the world should keep according to Judaism. So, not blaspheming, not stealing, not killing, things like that, not being promiscuous, and the seven laws altogether, which we say apply to the whole world. And we say that if any human being observes these laws, then, as the Talmud puts it, they are as holy as the high priest on the Day of Atonement in the Holy of Holies. It's pretty good stuff.
Those seven laws were pushed down into three laws later on. No sexual promiscuity, no killing, and no idolatry. And the three you find 40 different occasions in rabbinic literature, starting with Jubilees and then going on through all the Talmudic literature.
Well, as far as I'm aware, to this day,
The seven Noachian laws.
That's right.
Still,
the seven Noachian laws.
Yes,
yeah.
they're still part of Judaism.
Yes.
But I'm just saying that in rabbinic Judaism, they were summarized into those three, and you do find those three being affirmed in Acts 15 at the First Council of Jerusalem. That you have the church saying, "Well, we must keep at least these, because this is the core of our faith."
We see those as three of the most serious sins, but certainly, I would distinguish between those three and the seven that rabbinic Judaism to this day still regards as binding on everybody.
Yeah, well, we'll come back to this. We just reached the first end of the first part of our programme. Asking today, was Jesus just a rabbi? And we're going to be continuing to ask as we ask, we sort of explore some of the differences going forward between David Instone Brewer and Rabbi David Lister, who joined me on the programme today. Because obviously, as a Christian, David Instone Brewer believes that Jesus certainly was more than just a rabbi. He was the promised Messiah of the Jews. Well, that obviously isn't the way that Rabbi David Lister sees it. So we're going to continue this conversation in a moment's time here on Unbelievable. So do come back in just a moment's time.
Are we the products of chance or intention? Does the cosmos leave space for God? Does Darwin dispense with God? Does the human mind reflect a mind behind the universe? Exploring the God Question is a new six-part DVD study series investigating a major talking point of our time, science and God. Some of the world's best scientists and philosophers arguing from both sides of the debate with open, frank and rigorous discussion and fascinating results. Exploring the God Question is designed for individual or small group study as well as for schools and public presentation. To order and find out more, visit thegodquestion.tv/explore. Explore the search for truth.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the programme with me, Justin Brierley. We're looking at Jesus over the course of three programmes here on Unbelievable at the moment. Last week we asked, was he just a zealot? Next week we're asking, was he just a prophet. Today, though, we're asking, was Jesus just a rabbi? The 10-hour Bible mini-series is currently playing out on Channel 5 in the UK, and we're looking at the central figure of that series, Jesus, asking these questions about who was he. As the Christmas festival is shortly going to be commemorating, Christians believe he was the long-promised Messiah of the Jews. So answering that question from both sides of this conversation today are Reverend David Instone Brewer and Rabbi David Lister. I'm calling them Reverend David and Rabbi David just to differentiate them. Just to give you, again, a little bit of an idea of who they are, David Instone Brewer is a Bible scholar at Tyndale House, Cambridge. He's also an ordained Baptist minister, and he specialises in the rabbinics of the New Testament. Well, he believes Jesus certainly was a rabbi, though it might be a bit hard to define exactly what a rabbi was in the first century. He was an unusual one, though. Perhaps we'll talk about that as well. And he was more than just a rabbi. He was the Messiah of the Jews. Well, Rabbi David Lister from Edgware United Synagogue is, amongst other things, the writer of Intergalactic Judaism, I discovered while looking him up online. He finds the idea of Jesus as a rabbi intriguing but not persuasive, as we've heard. And he doesn't believe that Jesus fits with the traditional Jewish expectations of the Messiah. So let's talk about that, gentlemen. First of all, coming to you, Rabbi David, then and now, what did Jews believe the Messiah would be, as it were? What was the expectation, and what is the expectation for who the Messiah is and what they will bring?
The term Messiah in the Hebrew scripture is used to refer to anybody who is designated by God for a particular task. So King Cyrus is referred to as God's anointed one, his Messiah. And that's what the Messiah is, according to Judaism. It's somebody designated by God to achieve great things in the world, notably to put everything right. And we're hoping that such a person will gather the Jews from all around the world to Israel, to re-establish the temple, and to establish world peace and God's kingdom. And for this to happen, we need to be good enough to deserve it, or so bad that it's our last hope. We're working towards the former as best we can.
I was going to say, though the latter may not be that much out of sight either. You do believe that Messiah figure will be a person, a human?
Yes.
Okay. Will be born in a natural way, or will,
yes.
Will, yeah. So in that sense, you're looking at a very human person, but anointed by God for this special task.
Yes.
Okay. And what, as it were, would have to happen for you to recognise that person? They'd obviously be a very significant person, presumably. They'd come to world attention if they were causing or the centre around which these massive changes in society were occurring.
Yes, absolutely. They would be a very righteous Jewish person, a Jewish man, mm-hmm. who would be so influential and saintly that everybody would want to follow them.
Do you think it's possible, if someone appeared on the scene who seemed to be that all Jews would recognise that person as the Messiah, or would... I can anticipate that some would say, yes, he is, and some would say, no, he's not.
Yeah, well, indeed, you know, when you've got two Jews, you've got three opinions, and we're good at arguing. I think that if somebody is not universally accepted, then that just proves they're not the Messiah.
Okay.
And we just have to go with that, you know. Mm.
It would be beyond dispute as far as you're concerned.
Yeah.
No question.
Were. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And obviously for you, Jesus didn't fulfil those criteria.
That's correct. Well, because he didn't do those things. He didn't... when he came, the Jews were in their land, but shortly afterwards, they were exiled. Mm. Sadly, he didn't bring an era of world peace and a universal knowledge of God, although he did, at a certain point, have a third of the world, I believe, following Christianity, which is no mean feat. And you know, we celebrate the fact that so many people were brought to a knowledge of God, albeit in a way that we don't quite agree with. But that's an achievement. However, he's not done these other key points, and therefore we don't regard him as a Messiah.
Okay. So you believe, Reverend David, that Jesus was more than a rabbi. He was, in fact, the Messiah. Do you agree, though, with David, that he didn't fulfil the traditional expectations of what the Messiah would be?
I agree with his summary of what the Messiah is supposed to do, And, of course, I also agree that Jesus didn't finish that job. And I would see the prophecies that Jesus is going to come and finish it. And so he's going to have a second bite of the cherry and then bring the whole world together and bring world peace, like every beauty contestant says she wants.
What, though, in that sense, does convince you that Jesus was the Messiah, even if the fulfillment of that role was partial in a sense?
Well, certainly Jesus was a strange Messiah. He was born apparently illegitimately, so he was immediately had this scar of being rejected. He had a very small following, just 12 people, maybe 120 at times, and maybe 500, but there's very small following, much smaller than John the Baptist, for instance. And then he was killed in such a gruesome and terrible way that he would be rejected by everyone. So he was a very surprising Messiah. But then,
not the typical candidate, as far as Jews of the time would have seen.
And certainly not the way I would write it up. But I guess they had to write it because people already knew the story, and if they said something different, they'd reject it. But then you have this very strange thing that he also had these miracles, which were popping up all the time, so people couldn't ignore them. So he was a very strange person. And when he died and then he was seen after his death, everyone concluded, well, actually, he wasn't just a person. He was more than a person. That he was divine himself. So suddenly people started thinking, well, maybe he really was the Messiah, which he kept on almost denying during his life, saying, shh, don't tell anyone that if you've already concluded that. Mm. Let's keep that quiet. And it was a feeling that grew and grew and grew.
So that and obviously, when St. Paul came on the scene and had his radical conversion, what if you like, for him, a Torah-keeping, zealous Jew convinced him that Jesus was the Messiah? I guess, obviously, the fact that he had this Damascus Road experience as much as anything else, but he was obviously able to accommodate this Jesus who was radically different to what perhaps he was expecting, in a very different, they sort of see him as the Messiah in a completely new way.
I guess Paul followed what his master Gamaliel said, let's wait and see. And he saw, hey, this preaching of Jesus is actually growing, not diminishing after his death. Paul, I think, was convinced by his vision. Mm. But the theologies he developed afterwards shows that he thought through and saw that Jesus was a climax of Jewish theology and not a break with it.
Mm. In that sense, I suppose, Rabbi David, a Christian view of Jesus will always be something of a major break from Judaism, because they're willing to take, for instance, prophecies from the Old Testament about a Messiah figure and apply them in unusual ways to Jesus, would you say?
Yes, we feel that the application of Old Testament texts to Jesus is debatable, and we don't feel persuaded by them.
Give us some examples.
Well, for example, it says in Isaiah chapter 7, behold, the Alma has conceived and will give birth to a son. This word Alma in Hebrew is taken by some texts to mean a virgin, and it's taken to refer to the virgin birth. But in fact, it's not quite the Hebrew word that is used for a virgin. That's basuna, which is a different word altogether. So,
and Alma is more commonly translated as a young girl.
That's right.
And also, unmarried young girl.
Okay, we could talk about that. and also the context of that prophecy seems to be talking about something in the time of King Ahaz rather than many centuries later in the time of Jesus. So that's just a snapshot of how we view these quotations.
And so do you believe that the Messiah will be, as it were, born of an Alma? Or do you not particularly see that as a messianic prophecy in itself?
Precisely that. We don't see him as we don't see that as talking about the Messiah at all. Okay. It's talking about something that happened a long time ago.
That's interesting. So this is a scripture that's often heard at Christmas services, David, around this time of year. Behold, the virgin shall conceive and be with child, and so on. And from Isaiah. So what's your view of that particular verse as it relates to Jesus?
It is difficult to know whether you should translate as virgin or not, because Alma is an unmarried maiden. You don't expect people to unmarried to have children in those days.
So there would be a link between virginity and the word Alma, in as
well,
much
certainly,
as
yes.
you would expect an Alma to be a virgin.
But as David says, it's not a place where you'd expect to find a messianic prophecy. And really, you're seeing it in retrospect. Because Jesus' birth was so strange, you then start looking around in the Old Testament, and then you do see the strange prophecy in Isaiah, which wasn't entirely fulfilled in the time of Ahaz. So you think, oh, yeah, that is God giving us a hint about what's going to be happening.
Are there any other ones that you would point to as ones that were fulfilled by Jesus in his lifetime?
It's very difficult to find a killer prophecy by which I can convince someone who doesn't want to see Jesus as Messiah. You really have to see Jesus as Messiah, and then you read back in the Old Testament and you see hints. And that's always going to be the way God tells the future. He's not going to tell us, oh, on Thursday this is going to happen to you. He's going to give us hints so that when it does happen, we know he's still in control. We know that God still holds the universe together.
I mean, one that's often brought up, not so much in our Christmas services, but at Easter and so on, is passages in Isaiah about the suffering servant, and that was referring to the crucifixion.
Now, Jews nowadays would see that as talking about the suffering of the nation of Israel. Though it's interesting that in the Targums, which were first written down perhaps, in the early 2nd century, but the first lot of it was written down in the 60s, it was there they do take it as an individual and looking for an individual Messiah. So it looks like Jews have changed their minds on what that means. But then where you get two Jews, you get three opinions. As you say.
And I could agree with you that there are sources that refer to this passage as indeed talking about the Messiah. And we do say there is this idea of a great person suffering for the sins of the generation. That's within Judaism. So you know, I'm not going to hide that away. However, We would say that two objections to the use of that passage. One is that much of what the passage talks about can't be discerned. You know, he died. Did he die for the sins of the world? Well, we can't see that. Lots of people die. Everybody dies in the end. Doesn't mean that necessarily he died for our sins. It fits with the Christian theology, but it doesn't. It's not necessarily something that's borne out by the facts. And there's a detail also that troubles me about this, where it says he put his grave with the wicked, and he was with the rich in his death. Now, we'd say it's the other way around, that he was with the robbers when he died, and he was buried in the grave of a rich man, Joseph of Arimathea. So it doesn't quite fit with the account in the Gospel.
Yes, the parallelism is upside down, but that's the nature of parallelism. You, the two lines mean virtually the same, and you have different details in different lines.
Yes. I suppose, in the end, Reverend David, do you think that seeing Jesus as Messiah is something we ultimately take on faith more than, as it were, by a sort of deductive process?
Well, yes and no. The biggest historical detail that comes out of the Gospel, the one which is very difficult to get rid of, is the miracles. Because miracles are ones that don't want to be written down. No one wanted to record miracles of a religious figure in the first century.
Why do you say that? Why did no one want to record?
There were lots of new religions in the first century, and you could tell the complete scepticism that people have about them, especially when they're miracles concerned. You know, when people try to prove a religion with miracles, they say, "Ah, that's just another scam. That's just another money-making thing." And you find the church fathers, when they're teaching about Jesus, they don't mention the miracles. They say about his great teaching, and they keep quiet about the miracles because they can. But the gospel writers don't have that privilege. They're talking to people whose mothers or perhaps even themselves saw these things.
And Jesus was known as a miracle worker.
There was no getting away from it, so you had to mention it.
We find the miracles not quite persuasive. There's a passage in Deuteronomy which talks about somebody who comes along and gives you signs and wonders. And it says, if that takes you away from the God that you know, and the proof of this move to a different God is signs and wonders, don't listen to him. And we'd say that the notion of the Trinity, which perhaps was introduced by Jesus or around about that time, was as part of the whole Christian thing, is something that we weren't aware of. We'd say that hitherto it was absolutely pure monotheism. So we find the miracles difficult as something that might persuade us.
One of the traditions in the Talmud, which is almost certainly historical, is a charge sheet against Jesus saying that he was killed because he was a sorcerer. And because he led Israel astray, exactly as Rabbi David said.
Just tell us what this is, just for those who perhaps don't have the background. This is, as I understand it, part of the Talmud that was censored at some point in its history by
Very sadly, in order to get published in Europe, you had to get an imprimatur from the Pope to say that it can be published.
When would this have been around?
Around 1500.
1500s, right.
And in order to do that, they had to excise all the bits about Jesus.
And these were bits in the Talmud which essentially referred to Jesus as a criminal, a sorcerer who was...
Well, most of it is just horrible things about Jesus. You know, he's in hell boiling in excrement.
So sort of rhetoric. Against,
yeah.
Right.
But there's this passage which probably is a historical document. It looks like it because there are many additions to it to try and change some of the details, but they faithfully kept the original wording.
Mm.
And let me read it. It says, on the eve of Passover, they hung Yeshu the Nazarene. And a herald went out before him for 40 days, saying, Yeshu the Nazarene, or Nazareth, the Nazarite, will go out to be stoned for sorcery and misleading and enticing Israel to idolatry.
And so what's significant for you about that, then?
Oh, I see. Sorcery is very, very different from magic. There's a lovely debate between Abaibi and Hanina, was it? When they're talking about the difference between magic and sorcery. He says, I saw this man in the market. He cut a camel in two and then said some words and the camel came together again and walked off. And the other rabbi says, no, that was just magic. That was just a magic trick. There wasn't any feces. There's no blood. That's just... And magic was okay. Magic was, you know, looked down on.
Illusion.
But sorcery is deserves a death penalty because then you're doing real miracles by the power of the devil.
Mm.
And Jesus was killed for sorcery, according to Jews.
Right.
Because they couldn't dispute the miracles were actually happening. But obviously it must be the devil because it was Jesus.
I mean, do you want to chime in on this at all, Rabbi David? In terms of, I don't know whether there is any history of people you would regard as Orthodox Jews in the past where there have been associated miracles with their ministry and that kind of thing? Or is that very unusual?
But by and large, we're not desperately keen on miracles, surprisingly. there's a story in the Talmud about a man whose wife died and left him with a little child. And the Talmud says he grew a breast. And with this, he could feed his child.
Mm.
And one of the rabbis says, oh, how wonderful it was that God helped him. And another rabbi said, no, how horrible it was. Because we regard miracles as being a deviation from this beautiful order that God has put in the world.
Right.
And so we're not that persuaded by them. Prophecy is one thing. Mm. We're keen on prophets and we listen to what they say.
Mm.
But we don't regard a miracle per se, a change in the laws of nature, as being a persuasive or even a good thing.
Even though obviously there are many stories within the Old Testament of miraculous events of one nature or another.
We'd say that if it needed to be done and there was a message to be learned from it, like hitting the rock or whatever, then great.
Mm.
But not willy-nilly.
Okay, that's interesting. And so in that sense, Jesus is again a bit of an aberration as far as his ministry as a Jew and so on.
And I would agree that Jesus is an aberration throughout the whole of Scripture. There are really very few miracles in the Old Testament. When you count up the number of years and the number of miracles, there's one perhaps every two centuries. But Jesus, suddenly they're happening all over the place, and hundreds.
And what do you make, Rabbi David, of what Christians claim is obviously the ultimate miracle associated with Jesus, his resurrection from the dead? I mean, are you willing, first of all, to grant that Jesus was a historical character who was crucified, for instance, for his claims to be the Messiah or God or so on?
Oh my goodness, this is not my field of expertise. I can't really talk about the historicity of the New Testament. It's not my field, I'm afraid.
Just then, your thoughts on the claim of the resurrection. Is that something that for you is just a story, something that was came about after Jesus's followers, as it were?
I know I've looked through parts of the New Testament, and I know that in Matthew it says that there was a story about whether he was indeed resurrected. Towards the end it says that the Jews bribed the gods or something, and we might argue if there was some doubt about whether he was indeed resurrected, so did it indeed happen?
Mm.
If it did happen, well, there were other people who resurrected in biblical times when I think it was an Elisha was buried and his body touched somebody and that person came back to life. And there's stories of a little boy who was brought back to life after he died in the field. That doesn't necessarily mean that somebody's the Messiah.
Mm.
So I'd say we're not sure if it's true. And even if it is true, I'd say it's a miracle.
It wouldn't verify his claim to be the Messiah.
Yeah, to do that, you need to fulfil the prophecies and the traditions that we have.
Yeah. in a sense, I've heard it said, Reverend David, that the resurrection of Jesus was in itself, again, very unexpected if you're looking at a Jewish context. So do you want to talk about that? And
yes, I think no one would have predicted from the Old Testament that Jesus was going to rise from the dead. Once he does rise, then you look back at the Old Testament and you see some hints. But, no one would have predicted it. And it is a very strange thing to want to invent as well, because no Jew or Roman is going to believe in a religion that has a risen person. Because once you're dead, you're dead. And so the idea of reanimating a corpse is disgusting.
I mean, Jews obviously then and still believe in the general resurrection of the dead at the end of time on the last day. So was the resurrection of Christ in that sense somewhat anomalous within that theological framework?
It was acceptable to some Jews to think of a man coming back from the dead, not acceptable to Greeks and Romans. But not expected. No one would have regarded Jesus as less of a Messiah if he hadn't risen from the dead. And it's a very strange thing to invent.
Yeah, and for you then, I know you've written a book on what you've called Jesus scandals and the fact that some of these stories, which on the surface of it would have been very strange at the time, perhaps give us reason now to see that they weren't just inventions and forgeries and so on, because it would have been an odd story to create if you were trying to persuade someone of your...
Yes, I would say that you're creating problems for yourself by inventing that story, and that would be one reason why I look at it with less scepticism than others. But it is a very strange thing. You can't have a historian saying it really happened, because historians look for patterns, and when you've got a unique event, how can you confirm it?
Indeed. So you don't believe that Jesus was the Messiah, obviously, Rabbi David. What will the Messiah, when that Messiah comes, will it mean that everyone becomes Jewish in some sense? I'd just be interested to know sort of what that will entail, if you like. I think many Christians assume that perhaps at the return of Jesus, as it were, his claims will be finally vindicated for the whole world to see. Do you sort of anticipate the same thing, but from a Jewish perspective, for the Jewish Messiah, as it were?
There's a verse in the Old Testament which says that in those days the world will be full of the knowledge of God as the waters cover the sea. And this, I think, is what we're aiming at, that everybody will have a consciousness of God and will bond with him. Our role at that time will be simply to teach. You know, out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem, says in Isaiah. And there again, we see it as a privilege to be able to bring this about and share the teachings of Judaism with everybody else, not to make everybody Jewish, because not everybody needs to be Jewish. If you're born to a Jewish mother, we say you're Jewish. Mm-hmm. If you convert to Judaism, which you can choose to do if you want, then you're Jewish, but you don't have to. Apart from that, be a good person, keep those seven laws, and that's absolutely fine.
What do you make of those who are Jewish and have converted to Christianity? There's a movement that's sometimes described as Messianic Judaism. Do you see that as people who have firmly broken away from Judaism and become Christian, or is there any sense in which you can be a Christian and a Jew at the same time?
Well, we'd say there's two different things. There's what you are and what you do. So if you're born Jewish, you're Jewish. Mm. It's like, you know, if you've got blue eyes, that's that. So I'd say they're still Jews, but no, they've made a mistake, and as Jews they're supposed to be observing Judaism, you know, keeping the law and understanding it and being enriched and inspired by it. If somebody isn't Jewish, then in as much as Christianity encourages by and large these observance of these rules, you know, not killing, not stealing, and things like that, we don't have much of a problem with it for a non-Jewish person.
Yeah, interesting stuff. Thank you very much. We're just starting to approach the end of this section of the programme again. And let me just remind you, if you're listening and you would like to get involved, perhaps something Rabbi David or Reverend David have said on today's programme has inspired you or made you want to write in and complain. Either way, I'd be interested to hear from you. unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And of course, again, you can find this show and the links to the various podcasts, other websites, and resources and features and so on, all at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Again, that's premier.org.uk/unbelievable. And I'm also interested to hear your thoughts via Twitter and Facebook. We'll be back in just a moment's time as we start to wrap up our discussion asking today, was Jesus just a rabbi?
The church is facing a crisis of confidence. Should Christians still believe in the Bible? Can we have confidence in God? And does he have confidence in us? At Spring Harvest next Easter, discover why you can answer these questions yes, yes, and yes. Spring Harvest will challenge your thinking. It'll feed your mind and your spirit. Top Bible scholars will give substance to your confidence in God and his word. Find out more about Spring Harvest online. Sponsors of the Bible series on Channel 5.
Good afternoon. Welcome back to the third and final part of Unbelievable with me, Justin Briley, part of your range of programming every Saturday afternoon that aims to get you thinking. And don't forget that we've got our profile interview following straight on after today's program. And, well, can you get a bigger name than Cliff Richard? I don't think you can, especially not at Christmas time. And it's my pleasure to say that David Rose will be talking to Cliff about his extraordinary career, really, spanning, what is it, seven decades even possibly of time, and when he's had number one hits in every one of them. So do listen out for that between 4 and 5 this afternoon. I do hope as well that you're doing well in your Christmas preparations. If you want to send me your Christmas thoughts, Christmas greetings, as ever, you can email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And if you want some post-Christmas fun, theology and debate, then do tune in next week. We're continuing this this series asking, was Jesus just a, as we ask, was Jesus just a prophet? And that's going to be a discussion between Bible scholar James White, who's no stranger to this program. He joined me recently on a trip over from the States to interact with a Muslim on this question. Of course, Muslims do believe that Jesus was a prophet, a revered prophet, but he wasn't the Son of God. And so we're going to be doing that debate at the same time next week. So come back at 2:30 p.m. for that with me, Justin Briley, here on Unbelievable, and of course online at premier.org.uk/unbelievable.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
And the reason we've been asking, was Jesus just A, is because of the 10-hour Bible mini-series currently being played on Channel 5 in the evenings. Have you seen it? I'd be interested to hear your reactions to that as well, how you think it's portrayed the various stories from the Old and New Testament so far. The central figure, of course, of the series is Jesus, and as we've been asking these questions around who he was, we've been asking today, was he just a rabbi? Reverend David Instone Brewer, Bible scholar at Tyndale House, Cambridge, is on one side of our discussion today. On the other, Rabbi David Lister, who is helps to lead, certainly, Edgware United Synagogue. We've been talking about, in the latter part of the programme, whether Jesus did or didn't fulfil messianic expectations. And in a sense, you've both agreed that, no, he didn't fulfil them. Obviously, Reverend David, in your view, he was nonetheless the Messiah, even if a somewhat unexpected Messiah. Now, how would you go about, and would you, in a way, try to convince David that Jesus was, in fact, the Messiah that he has been waiting for, longing for, expecting?
Well, first of all, I'd say that Jesus was fulfilling prophecies, but he hasn't finished yet.
Okay.
Yeah. And David has been so polite about Jesus, saying that he was a good man and a great teacher, and it sounds like you'd invite him to preach in your synagogue if he was still around. But I suspect
that would be a bit of an exclusive, wouldn't it? Yeah.
I suspect that you'd probably bar him if you heard some of the things he would claim, especially about himself. You know, when he says about talking about God as his father, which almost got wholly excommunicated by using the same sort of terms, saying that he and his father are one. And especially when he says, where two or three are gathered, there I am in their midst, which must be a comment on that famous rabbinic saying, which was around at his time, you know, where two study the Torah together, there's a Shekinah in their midst. And he's saying, I'm like the Shekinah, I'm like the presence of God.
And for you, obviously, those claims, Reverend David, are claims that only someone who I guess was either very deluded would make, or someone who perhaps was actually true, was saying something true about themselves.
I think you either have to fall on your face or throw stones at him when he says that.
And, of course, both happened in the New Testament to Jesus. Yeah, your comments.
I'd say that some of the things that Jesus said about himself were things that we encourage everybody to say about themselves. You know, we regard every human being as made in the image of God and a child of God. We regard everybody as able to bring the divine presence down into the world, and indeed that's our duty. So I'd say rather than it being the exclusive preserve of one man, let's share this with everybody.
But of course, the people who heard him regarded it rather differently. They did pick up stones. They saw this as being a bigger claim than just saying, hey, I'm one of the children of God.
Perhaps, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, in that sense, what would it take to convince you, for instance? It strikes me almost that it's almost too late now for you to ever be convinced, Rabbi David, that Jesus could have been the Messiah, because, you, as you say, even if it could be shown that he rose from the dead, that for you wouldn't in itself be enough of a sort of confirmation, because you just don't feel that those other big aspects of what the Messiah is supposed to do have been fulfilled.
That's correct, yeah.
Yeah. So we're at a bit of an impasse at this point, I suppose, Reverend David, in as much as if most Jews don't believe that Jesus did fulfill those messianic expectations, how would you then go on to try to convince them that actually he did, or that these sayings that he had about himself were in some sense a fulfillment of those expectations?
I would love all Jews to come to know Jesus, but I'm not so worried about Jews as about other people who don't know God at all.
Why do you say that?
People who are still searching for God, who don't know that he's there, don't know that he loves them, Jews will find out that Jesus is the Messiah, hopefully before they die, but perhaps at death. And certainly when he comes, then all Jews will suddenly recognize that. That's how I see the prophecies that you were referring to about the when everyone sees the Messiah when he comes. But there are so many people for whom life is just empty of God, and who have no reason for living, and who throw their lives away in destructive ways. Mm. They're the people that I want to reach with the gospel.
Mm, that's interesting stuff. Just as we start to close out today's programme, Rabbi David, anything you'd add in terms of what we've been speaking about today as regards the way you regard Jesus, the role he plays? You are part of some interfaith organisations, and so you're used to, as it were, talking about the differences that exist between what you believe in Christians and Muslims and so on. How best to proceed, then, when we do hold very different views about the nature of Jesus? Is it simply a case of continuing these conversations and being gracious as we do so?
Well, first of all, we should all be gracious and courteous, you know, because as far as I'm concerned, as far as Judaism is concerned, everybody's made in the image of God, and we should seek to find that image in other people and nurture it. Beyond that, I'd say what the former chief rabbi Jonathan Sacks said, which is that in interfaith work, we don't look for face-to-face so much as side-by-side. So this sort of conversation that we're having is interesting. I find it very stimulating. Mm. And for people who have a sort of scholarly interest in religion, then that's all to the good. Of people who want to just deepen their understanding of what they are and what others are, that's fine. But in a broader perspective, I'd say let's find goals that we can work on together. There are so many things that we all care about, you know, poverty, justice, the environment, and things like that. Let's work together on those things. And rather like after the flood, there was this beautiful rainbow with all these different colours next to each other, making this beautiful pattern. That's a template for humanity, that we can be different. It's hard for us not to be different, but we can still work together and create a beautiful thing altogether in our different ways.
Thank you very much for being on the programme today. It's been
Thank you for having me.
Lovely to meet you. And if people want to find out more about you, is there anywhere they should particularly visit or search for online?
They can contact me via the Edgware United Synagogue website, which is edgwareu.com.
Great, thank you very much. David, thanks again for coming in and sharing a bit of your scholarship and obviously engaging in the discussion today. Do you also see it as a sort of a valuable thing to rub up against people who are from obviously a very different faith perspective to you in that sense?
I find it very inspiring and invigorating to meet people who disagree with me.
Good. Well, I'll arrange for a few more down the line as well. If people want to find out more about you, any particular websites you'd recommend they visit?
Google me or davidinsoenborough.com.
Great. That's the ways to find out more. And I'm, of course, going to put those links with today's podcast as well if you want to visit the website of Unbelievable. And, of course, I'll link to some of the previous shows we've done on not dissimilar themes around the claims of Jesus, other discussion programs we've done with rabbis and Jews. So premier.org.uk/unbelievable for those links. Look forward to hearing what you thought of today's program as well. Do email in and I'll give you the ways to get in touch in just a moment's time as we go to some of your feedback on the last few weeks of programming. In the meantime, thanks very much to David Insoenborough and Rabbi David Lister.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, if you want to have your say on the discussion today, you can always get in touch, as ever, by email. That's unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Looking forward to hearing your responses. And loads of responses have come in over the last few weeks to the various shows we've done. Going to be looking at some of your responses in a moment to the Reza Aslan and Anthony Ledon debate on the historical Jesus. Last week, as we asked, was Jesus just a zealot? Still lots of responses, of course, to Richard Dawkins the week before, debating the Old Testament morality. And, of course, intelligent design and charismatic stuff from the Strange Fire Conference. All will be revealed, what you thought of all those programmes, in a moment's time. Don't forget, of course, you can also send me your thoughts via the Unbelievable Facebook page, facebook.com/unbelievablejb. And you can also send me a tweet, @unbelievablejb, to follow me on Twitter. All the links and more available from the website. Going to be hearing as well in a short moment's time from N.T. Wright, Bible historian N.T. Wright. Another of his thoughts, answers really, to a tough Bible question. We're going to be hearing why he believes the historical resurrection of Jesus can be trusted. So that's coming up in a moment's time as well. Just a quick reminder that this programme, and indeed last week's and next week's, are all related, in a kind of loose way at least, to the Bible TV series that's been on Channel 5 here in the UK through December. And I believe it's the final episode tonight. So if you want to catch that, it's at 10 o'clock tonight on Channel 5. If you're going to tweet about it, can I encourage you to use the hashtag TheBibleUK? So the big finale tonight on Channel 5. And you can, of course, find out more, see resources, interviews and so on at the webpage of the that we've got on the website, premier.org.uk/the Bible. premier.org.uk/the Bible. So going back to last week's programme, that was Reza Aslan, the author of the controversial book Zealot, claiming that Jesus was not the peace-loving Messiah of the Gospels, but was in fact a revolutionary. Then we've had quite a lot of interesting response here. Listeners split, both Christian and non-Christian, as to how effectively his claims were answered by Anthony Ledon. Some people felt Ledon was a bit snobbish, even in the way he treated Reza Aslan in that particular debate. Here's Nick Quinn in San Jose, California, says, wow, what a spectacularly uncomfortable show this was. As always, it was incredibly interesting to hear their points of view, but it was cringeworthy to hear Ledon's attacks on Aslan's professional integrity. He may have been right, but none of his arguments seemed to land. It was also hard to hear Aslan's incredibly long responses, even though he was much more gracious to Ledon. All in all, I kept thinking how hard it must have been to moderate it all. Nice job, Justin. Have a very Merry Christmas. Thank you very much, Nick. Ryan wants to say it was a good programme. Dr. Ledon provided a good opponent to Dr. Aslan. Aslan wrote in Zealot a popularisation of what's really a minority opinion among Jesus scholars. He did seem a bit defensive when his views were challenged. I definitely support and enjoy literary and historical criticism when applied to the Bible. If God appears in history, we should expect it as orthopraxy to study scripture in its cultural context. It can even show the Bible to be a reliable anthology when the text is concerned with historical purposes. And you point back to the dialogues that James Crossley had with Richard Borkham on this show several years ago. One thing to note, however, and I don't want to sound too cheeky, I find the best books on the historical Jesus to be written by Saints Matthew, Mark, Luke and John. Nothing beats the original historians, says Ryan. Thank you very much for getting in touch. Again, if you want to send me your thoughts in on that, do email unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can hear the show again, of course, by going to the webpage premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Now, the week before, it was Professor Richard Dawkins, probably the best known atheist in the world, by all accounts. He was in conversation with a Reformed rabbi, Josh Levy, and Christian historian Chris Sinkinson on the Old Testament, its morality, some of the stories, the ones that we don't tend to read out in church all that often because they're a bit gory, a bit gristly. And what do we make of it all? Here's again, Ryan, I couldn't resist this one. He's put together a sonnet. He says, Dawkins really likes to make statements about how much he really dislikes American Christians, presumably evangelicals. Well, I speak as an American Catholic who admires the Pascalian fire of many American evangelicals. So I've written a sonnet to defend their honour. Why There Almost Certainly Is No Dawkins, it's titled. To the living twin of the Ditchkins pair, I mourn when I see what's arguably, in fact, the most unpleasant character in all publication. He remarks in many snide smirks that most Americans believe something as true as fairy stories, and Chesterton rolls in his grave. Try conceive, please, that human beings might be more than just hairless bipedal primates, that there is, in the real myth of primordial Adam, primal truth, and that, in Hebrew, it's announced living souls are what make humans dare to discover. If such is a shelf for fiction, then even great Darwin will be sectioned. There you go. Thank you, Ryan. Talented young man with those poems coming out. Stephen Jackson says, you're surely right in saying there must be some humour somewhere when you get an atheist, a Jewish rabbi and a Christian scholar into your studio. In the story of Abraham, Abraham's belief that God would provide a sacrifice in the place of Isaac is vindicated. Interestingly, it's the supernatural being who is given as the beneficiary of the incident because he now knew that Abraham feared God. But what of Isaac? Now, Richard Dawkins has stated that Isaac suffered abuse, presumably mental abuse, in the form of fear. Did Isaac come to trust his father more? No more did he simply have to trust his words. He was party to the remarkable event. He heard and even saw the supernatural visitor and saw that God did provide as his father had said. So Isaac's faith and knowledge of God very likely increased significantly. And the outcome of the event might well have been that his life was enriched to a profound level. Says Stephen. David says that when it came to that show, there seemed a reluctance on all sides to engage with the texts that are difficult for Christians to interpret. Levy did not really explain how liberal Jews deal with them either, except to regard them as part of their heritage. I thought there was going to be an opening when Chris Sinkinson referred to the stoning of rebellious sons laid down in Deuteronomy 21. At last, we were going to get beyond niceties and circumlocutions, I thought. Why does God command acts that we nowadays would unquestionably call evil? But this was not taken up, swallowed up by generalities about engaging with the text. But I admire your persistence on these issues. Christians need to get a coherent story to link the Old Testament with the God revealed through Jesus. Why not get Randall Rouser back to talk on this, maybe with an atheist like Justin Sheba, rather than with the sort of pussycat that Richard Dawkins turned out to be, says David. Okay, one more maybe. Matthias in Norway says, I think Richard Dawkins won this debate, even though I'm a Christian. These are for these reasons. Firstly, his opponents failed to respond to his incoherent view on morality. And second, they apparently accept more or less his premise that the Old Testament is a collection of non-inspired myths, particularly their treatment of the Sodom and Gomorrah passage. And you go on to sort of explain your reasons why you think that Dawkins' view on morality is incoherent and the Sodom and Gomorrah story and so on. I mean, just to wave a little flag there for Chris Sinkinson, he emailed me earlier this week and said from the responses he's getting, people seem to have assumed he has a more liberal view of the Old Testament than he actually holds. And I think if you listen carefully to what he actually said on that programme, he certainly wouldn't have said that the Old Testament is a collection of non-inspired myths. He did talk about myth as a category that applies to some aspects of the Old Testament, but not but that doesn't necessarily mean it didn't happen as such. But in general, I think Chris Dinkinson is happy to go with the historicity of the vast majority of what's down there as historical stories, if you like. Anyway, good to hear from you. Thank you for getting in touch, Matthias. Glad you're listening there in Norway. And we're going to hear some of your responses on the issue of intelligent design in just a moment as well. Before we get to that and some of your responses to the strange fire controversy with John MacArthur, let's hear from N.T. Wright. He's a Bible historian. He joined me earlier in the year on Unbelievable. Well, I also got him to give me some of his answers to some of your tough Bible questions, especially in light of this Bible TV series that's been airing on Channel 5. And here's one of the questions that I had him respond to. Tom, what do you say to those who say that Jesus' resurrection, well, it's just a legend, isn't it?
Well, of course, in the ancient world, there were lots of legends, lots of myths, lots of things floating around. My problem as a historian is that unless you say Jesus of Nazareth was raised from the dead, it is very, very difficult to explain historically many of the features of early Christianity. Just take what all the early Christians believed about what happens to people after their death. That's actually a very traditional thing. If you do a funeral, if you go to a family funeral, people want it to be pretty much like we've always done it, and they will say the same things as they've always done. Now, there's a whole range of opinions in the ancient world, pagan and Jewish, about what happens to people after they die. Astonishingly, in early Christianity, they all say, after we die, if we belong to Christ, we will rest, and then we will be raised from the dead on the last day to share in God's new world. That's a major revolution. Why did that happen? That breaks all the cultural norms that they came from. They all say it's because of what God did to Jesus. Now, that's just one argument out of dozens, but there are all sorts of lines pointing back which say, we know that dead bodies don't rise. They knew that dead body, you know, people sometimes say, oh, we have modern science, so we prove that resurrection can't happen. This is ridiculous. Plato knew that dead people don't rise. Homer knew that. Socrates knew that. This is not a new discovery. But they said, no, this is because God's new world, the Creator God, is launching his new world. And this is the beginning of it. The resurrection is not an isolated, bizarre event within the old world. It is the beginning event within the new world, but the new world nests within and is transforming the old world.
Dramatic music there from the Bible TV series, and if you are able to watch, it's on again tonight, final episode, 10 o'clock on Channel 5. If you want more resources, go to premier.org.uk/thebible. And if you want to watch the videos that audio is taken from of N.T. Wright responding and giving answers to some of those questions, then why not go to the Unbelievable webpage where they're on the video player there, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. OK, I'm running short of time, as always. Quickly, one on the intelligent design debate between Stephen Meyer and Charles Marshall. Stephen Meyer, of course, the author of Darwin's Doubt, Charles Marshall, an evolutionary biologist. Gerard Zimmerman says, just wanted to tell you that the last Unbelievable episode between Meyers and Marshall was not only one of the finest episodes I've heard, but also, without a doubt, the best debate I've encountered between an intelligent design proponent and a supporter of evolutionary theory. I've been following that controversy closely over the last few years, and I've never before heard such a calm and well-mannered discussion on the issues. I'd like to particularly congratulate you for managing to rein in Dr. Meyer's habit of talking too quickly and over the top of other participants. Thank you again, says Gerard. Glad you enjoyed it, Gerard. Thank you for listening. And finally, let's talk about strange fire. This was the controversy when John MacArthur, well-known Bible teacher in the USA, appeared to condemn vast numbers of Christians as heretics, saying that the charismatic movement was a sham. Here's a number of your responses to the discussion I hosted on that between charismatic blogger Adrian Warnock and cessationist Doug Wilson. Someone wanting to remain anonymous says, "I've felt uncomfortable with John MacArthur's teaching for some time. Whenever I've heard his talks, he's invariably denouncing either some group of Christians or non-Christians. I wonder if he's off track. I'm finding his teaching really discouraging." Another says, "It's interesting to find out that I've been in deception for nearly 50 years. Well, it's certainly been a blessed time, and I intend to continue in it by the grace of God. Otherwise, I might as well return to the dead form of the synagogue." The definition of strange fire is found in Leviticus 10, verses 1 to 2. Paul Larson in New York says, regarding strange fire, "Unfortunately, Adrian just doesn't seem to get it. If he would channel his MacArthur indignance more vociferously towards his gift-abusing charismatic brethren, then MacArthur's diatribe wouldn't be necessary." Yet that didn't seem to even be on his radar. Here's one from John, who says, "I think for me the charismatic and reformed views both converge on Mark 3:29 and preceding verses. Both sides can end up blaspheming the Holy Spirit, and both sides need to use the gift of discernment. My biggest concern was the attitude of the reformed person, because they stand the chance of committing the same sin referred to in Mark 3:29. The Holy Spirit blows like the wind. Nobody knows where he comes from or goes," says John 3, verse 8. "So we can't judge him or fully understand him. Likewise, if charismatics fake things, then that's misrepresenting the Holy Spirit. That's also a blasphemy. Both sides need to show discernment," says John. And here's one from Ruth, who says, "Listening to today's show, as I understand it, cessationists believe that the teaching on spiritual gifts was only for those alive at the time. This seems dangerous to me, as surely the same argument could be applied to any part of Scripture someone didn't want to accept. Now, as for the gift of tongues, I once heard a preacher say that we should all speak in tongues. Well, I did not, and do not now, believe that this is a biblical point of view. And in any case, I found the idea terrifying for myself. However, as I was walking my dog early one morning and singing 'How Great Thou Art,' I suddenly found I wasn't singing in English. Far from being terrified, I was quite excited. Having decided to give me this gift, God then showed me how to use it when he sent me prayer walking regularly around a section of my neighbourhood. I don't always know how to pray, and then the tongues took over. However, I do think that with all gifts, we have to be sure they're from God and that we know how he wants us to use them. Thank you for a really interesting show. I try not to miss it." Thank you very much. Yeah, interesting stuff. Thanks to all those who have been in touch, and I will be bringing more of your feedback across all those shows on next week's programme. So thank you for joining me today on Unbelievable. Do come again, same time, same place, next week. Let me tell you what's coming up then. You're unbelievable. Well, next week we ask, was Jesus just a prophet? Yes, the final of our three shows looking at the person of Jesus. James White of Alpha and Omega Ministries joins me to debate with Yusuf Ishmael, a young South African Islamic scholar. Hope you can be here, same place, same time, and of course online at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Goodbye now if you're with me on podcast. If you're staying here on Premier Christian Radio this Saturday afternoon for Faith Explored, real treat for you next. David Rose is in conversation with none other than Cliff Richards.